Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Liz Ryan Murray of National People's Action, who talks about efforts underway to hold big U.S. banks accountable for their misconduct around subprime mortgages and foreclosure fraud. Emily Worth of the group Food and Water Watch, who discusses legislative and grassroots efforts to stop or slow down the hydraulic fracturing or fracking method of extracting natural gas from shale. And Natalie Foster, CEO of the Rebuild the American Dream campaign, who discusses how the newly organized Progressive Coalition plans to challenge corporate-funded Tea Party politics in Washington, D.C. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the decade since the 9/11 terror attack, the New York Police Department has conducted unprecedented intelligence operations in Muslim communities, including assigning covert agents to area mosques. An investigation by the Associated Press conducted over 40 interviews with retired and current New York Police Department and federal officials detailing operations which appear to violate civil liberties protections. The NYPD often use so-called rakers in ethnic communities who observe daily life in bars, nightclubs, and bookstores to seek out useful intelligence on potential terrorists. The NYPD also used what they called Muslim crawlers to monitor services in mosques, even though there was no evidence of any wrongdoing. The aggressive intelligence sweeps occurred after the NYPD hired David Cohen, a retired CIA agent, to run its intelligence unit in early 2002. Among his most controversial operations was to perform background checks on every Pakistani cab driver working in New York City. In response to the AP investigation, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, a civil rights group, called on the U.S. Justice Department to investigate possible wrongdoing. Chris Dunn of the New York Civil Liberties Union observed that the NYPD intelligence unit has gotten extremely aggressive and sophisticated, but is operating completely on its own. There is no oversight. In October of 2005, a spark triggered an explosion at a Tropicana juice processing plant in Bradenton, Florida. Several workers were badly burned in the fire. An investigation by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, concluded the fire could have been prevented if the company, a division of PepsiCo, had followed basic safety rules. For a decade before the explosion occurred, the plant was labeled a model workplace and participated in OSHA's Voluntary Workplace Programs, or VPP, initiated during the Reagan administration. VPP exempted model companies from regular OSHA inspections, including chemical plants, refineries, and sawmills. But according to the Center for Public Integrity, 80 workers have died at VPP sites since 2000. In investigating these deaths, OSHA identified a consistent pattern of workplace violations, including poor inspections and training, and a lack of proper protective equipment. Yet, companies are rarely ever expelled from the VPP program. In the event of a workplace death, a VPP participating company only received an average $8,000 fine. Mike Wright, head of health and safety for the United Steelworkers of America Union, says the VPP was established with good intentions, but the program has gotten out of control. After a two-week strike, 45,000 Verizon workers from Virginia to New England, including landline telephone technicians and consumer representatives, went back to work without a new contract. Larry Cohen, president of the Communication Workers of America, says the strike ended because Verizon withdrew major concession demands and agreed to extend the current contract until a new labor agreement is reached. Verizon claims it needs to reduce employee benefit plans because of increasing competition and reduced profitability. But with a surging wireless division, Verizon has made over $22 billion in profits since 2007. The top five executives at the telecom giant made over $258 million in compensation over the last 4 years, and the company secured $1.3 billion in tax rebates from Uncle Sam in 2010. Volatile issues like health care and job security remain on the negotiating table. Union members expressed concern that Verizon could impose 12-hour workdays, forcing union technicians to repair mistakes made by its non-union replacements during the walkout. Striking CWA and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers had picketed outside Verizon Wireless stores to dissuade customers from doing business with the telecom company. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
Representatives of all 50 states are negotiating with the largest U.S. banks to settle charges of improper conduct on mortgage servicing and their involvement in producing hundreds of thousands of fraudulent robo-signed mortgage documents. But Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, who is spearheading the investigation, has recently dismissed New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman from the 13-member executive committee guiding the negotiations, charging that Schneiderman had undermined the group's effort to reach a settlement. Schneiderman objects to a proposed deal with the banks that would prevent further investigations and prosecution of financial institutions' reckless bundling or securitizing risky mortgages as investments, which in part triggered the 2008 global economic meltdown. The banks, some Obama administration officials, the Justice Department, and HUD are reportedly pushing for a deal to be reached quickly. A spokesperson for Schneiderman says ongoing investigations by attorneys general cannot be shut down by efforts to settle quickly, and those responsible must be held accountable. The New Bottom Line campaign, a coalition of grassroots community, faith, and labor organizations, supports Schneiderman's stand and is demanding a strong settlement agreement with principal reductions for those at risk of foreclosure, criminal penalties for bankers who committed mortgage fraud, restitution for families who lost their homes due to fraud, and strict enforcement of the settlement terms on the banks. Your reporter spoke with Liz Ryan Murray, policy director with National People's Action, a member organization of the New Bottom Line campaign. She discusses Schneiderman's dismissal and protest actions being planned to hold big banks accountable.
The attorneys general really started this investigation out of the robo-signing scandal that hit last year. And robo-signing is where banks, you know, in their rush to make all of these mortgages and to make all these subprime and mortgages that brought down our economy, were not careful about what they did with their paperwork. They transferred titles, they did all these things, and nobody really necessarily knew where the paperwork was. Come time, they want to start throwing people out of their houses, and they can't prove they own them. So instead of doing the due diligence and figuring out what's going on and trying to save people's homes, they've set up warehouses of people signing their names over and over again, that they were notaries or vice presidents of banks, just over and over again, blatant forgery and fraud to throw people out of their homes. When that hit, all attorneys general, all 50 of them, came together to start investigating that and some of the other fraud that was going on in foreclosure practices, people not getting a fair shake to really save their homes, people having to submit paperwork 10, 15, 20 times and then still getting thrown out of their homes. So they really started to look at that and try to come up with a solution to start to make people whole and to start cleaning up the Banks Act, hold them accountable for what they've been doing, and make them stop doing it. What happened is the banks now are being investigated for this. They want to reach a settlement that lets them off scot-free for everything, from soup to nuts. They steered people into mortgages when they could have afforded cheaper mortgages. They steered them into more expensive ones, especially blacks and Latinos. So the banks, they want to sign on the dotted line, get a really quick settlement, get off easy, and then be held not culpable for any of that. They want it all over with. And Eric Schneiderman is saying, hold on, we haven't done an investigation into any of these things. We can't let them off the hook for all the securitization fraud, the chain of title fraud, the origination fraud, when we haven't looked at it. He's saying whatever solution you come up with, other attorneys general, you can't close the door on me and some of the other states actually going after and getting some relief for homeowners and investors on that end.
Liz, what's the role of the Obama administration been in terms of aggressively going after the banks or just working out some sweetheart deal with the big banks? And as President Obama's fond of saying, looking forward and not looking backward, which has a lot of people angry, of course, because they want accountability.
Absolutely. I mean, we can't paper over this. It's hard to say. At the moment, again, there's some of the signs that we're seeing are not incredibly encouraging. The Department of Justice is also a part of this investigation with the 50 attorneys general. They're going to be signing off on this as well. What we're hearing is that they are also pushing for speed. And speed is great if it's going to really help people. Because as I said, there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of folks losing their homes. And if we can help them, that's great. But we can't let speed be the enemy of doing something with quality. So we're hearing that they're pushing for quickness, and we just can't have quickness if it means no real help.
If you were to put in a nutshell what your group's demands are here in terms of the attorney generals that are negotiating with the big banks and the Obama administration and their Justice Department, what's the most important demand you guys have?
I think principal reduction, because that's the real solution. Until people get an opportunity to actually build some wealth again, and that goes in hand with an opportunity to really modify their mortgage to an affordable place where they can stay in their homes. If we can get the mortgage market and do this kind of massive reset, we're going to be on so much stronger footing economically and in the housing market and the jobs market. I would say another biggie is the release of claims issue that we've talked about at length, that we have to make sure that this is narrow, that we're just giving release here on what's been investigated and not the whole host of the problem. And I would add one more that's also very important. This has been going on for several years, and there are thousands, millions, honestly, of families who have lost their homes, and probably, oh, definitely, we've seen the paperwork, many of them illegally. There needs to be restitution for those folks. If it's possible for them to get their house back, they need to get their house back. If it's not, then they need to be compensated at a degree that's measured with the harm. We can't just forget those people. So we need to take care of the people who are struggling now. Take care of the people who have already been tossed out due to this criminal fraudulent system, just addressing the part of the problem that has been investigated.
What's happening in terms of street action to demand the government, Congress, our representatives in Washington, do something to hold these banks accountable?
Absolutely. I mean, it's key to what we do, and it's in our blood to really, and we're really trying to give a voice. People are incredibly frustrated, and people are angry about what the banks have gotten away with and with the fact that the poorest in our country and those who can least afford it are being asked to shoulder all the burden. So we're really bringing that message out to the streets. We started with, in August, doing some town hall work. Our group in Iowa are actually the ones who got Mitt Romney to admit that corporations, in his opinion, are people. Keeping that up to bring that message. And then starting in September and through October, we're going to be having rolling, sustained actions around the country. In New York, they're going to really be focusing on the millionaire's tax. The fact that New York is sitting on $5 billion a year annually that they're not taking by letting the millionaire's tax expire at the end of the year. In Chicago, we're going to have a week or more of actions focused in part on the Mortgage Bankers Association who are coming to town, getting on the street, tying these things of bank accountability and really addressing the revenue crisis. There'll be actions in Minnesota, on the West Coast, across the middle of the country, all through September and into October.
That was Liz Ryan Murray, Policy Director at National People's Action and member of the new Bottom Line campaign. Visit our Between the Lines website to learn more about groups demanding accountability from big banks involved in mortgage fraud. Shale gas development has been touted as the biggest breakthrough in U.S. fossil fuel production in decades, allowing the natural gas industry to drill in areas that were previously inaccessible and proclaiming in media ads that the process, known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking, is the clean, safe domestic power of the future. But fracking, in which millions of gallons of water, a secret mix of toxic chemicals and sand, are injected into wells to break apart shale and release trapped gas, has been found to pollute groundwater. One of the biggest areas being developed is the Marcellus Shale, a formation that covers parts of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Virginia. Another shale formation covers the northern tip of New Jersey, whose legislature recently voted overwhelmingly to ban shale gas drilling. But New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie announced on August 24th that instead of signing the ban bill, he was declaring a one-year moratorium so the process could be further evaluated. Meanwhile, a moratorium in New York on what many consider the most disruptive form of shale gas development is about to end as the state's Department of Environmental Conservation is releasing a revised environmental impact study on the issue at the end of August. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Emily Wirth, Water Program Director at the Washington, D.C.-based group Food and Water Watch, which is pushing for a national ban on hydraulic fracturing to extract natural gas. She discusses the legislative and grassroots citizen efforts to stop or slow down fracking and points to the need for the nation to start developing renewable energy alternatives.
The New Jersey state legislature overwhelmingly voted for a ban on hydraulic fracturing in New Jersey earlier this year, and we have been waiting to see what Governor Christie would do on this. And instead of doing what was clearly in the best interest of the residents of New Jersey and what the state legislature wanted, he passed a conditional veto that would only establish a one-year moratorium on fracking, saying that had to do with waiting for further study to see what the effects were. That timeline is not in line with the EPA study, which is the most documented study that's looking into the effects of hydraulic fracturing on drinking water primarily. They will be doing some examination of other effects as well. But that study is not due to have any preliminary findings until the end of next year, which a lot of times these agency studies run over schedule, and then it's not due to be complete until 2014. So we have serious concerns, and at this point we're hoping that the state legislature, who had the votes needed to override the veto, will in fact put this to vote and vote to override Governor Christie's veto.
The vote was almost unanimous in the Senate, and I'm wondering if that was because even if shale drilling were allowed, there's very little shale in the state that holds gas that could be drilled for.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is some, and I think it sends an important message to the elected officials of neighboring states, Pennsylvania and New York, for them to take this action. I mean, you know, the waterways cross state lines, and we know there's been a hotly debated decision being made by the Delaware River Basin Commission about this, and that is subject to come up for a vote any time now. It could be as soon as the September 21st meeting. But, you know, the Delaware River provides drinking water for 3 million residents of New Jersey, so I think this was an effort made by the state legislature to weigh in on some of the larger regional decisions being made about this practice.
There was also a moratorium declared in New York State in 2010. Can you give us a little background?
What the New York State legislature voted for was a moratorium on both types of hydraulic fracturing, so vertical and horizontal. This gets into the slightly more technical side of this issue. There were lots of concerns because the vertical drilling is already taking place in New York State, in western New York in particular. And so what Patterson did was also a veto. He vetoed the state legislature's moratorium and made it only on the horizontal drilling, which is the kind of more invasive form, although there's problems with all of them, really.
So the moratorium was to stay in place until the revised environmental impact statement is released, and that's slated for August 31st, and then the public comment period begins.
That essentially ends the moratorium in New York, although permits won't be issued until they go through an official public comment period and actually then take the time to insert the public comment into a final draft.
So, Emily Wirth, things seem to be moving fast toward opening New York State to drilling, and I know the Department of Environmental Conservation's initial environmental impact statement in July said it could be allowed on most private property, but not in public parks or watersheds. It seems like a ban is pretty much out of the question.
I don't. I think that the next few months are critical, but we've seen movement. We've seen elected officials in New York who are not naturally, you know, prone to be strong on this issue come out really strongly. Republican Greg Ball comes to mind from the Hudson Valley area, and he's recently just was touring through counties like Bradford County and Susquehanna County in Pennsylvania where the intensive drilling has taken place, and has come back with a really strong statement saying he doesn't want to see this happen in New York. And so, you know, I think the next few months will be very important for the movement, but we're hoping that kind of gives people the opportunity to take a strong stance on this issue, including the state legislature in New York.
You know, it's interesting that this is happening now at the same time that people are in D.C. trying to stop the importation from Canada of incredibly polluting tar sands for fuel. Maybe it would be better to develop domestic natural gas and forget about the tar sands.
I think there's a lot of other opportunities in renewables and more sustainable, less dangerous and less polluting forms of energy, and that there's got to be more investment in research and kind of the startup of those. And I just also think, you know, that the oil and gas industry is tremendously powerful. And, you know, at Food & Water Watch, we think the kind of visionary route is to move away from the mature fossil fuel industries. Particularly, we shouldn't be subsidizing and granting exemptions to a profitable, mature industry. But instead, we should be investing in the technologies needed to really fully develop the sustainable and safe renewable sources of energy.
That was Emily Wirth of Food & Water Watch. Learn more about the efforts to stop natural gas hydraulic fracturing on our website at btlonline.org. Earlier this year, Van Jones, the former Obama administration's special advisor for green jobs, who resigned after right-wing groups attacked his past affiliations and character, launched a new project called Rebuild the American Dream Campaign. The campaign's goal is to steer the nation away from the Tea Party-driven austerity, tax-cut political agenda in Washington, and focus instead on strengthening working families by creating good jobs and making sure that all Americans pay their fair share of taxes. Working with MoveOn.org and dozens of other peace, social justice, labor, and environmental groups, Rebuild the Dream organized more than 900 House meetings across the U.S. in mid-July, where those attending selected priority issues and hammered out what they dubbed the Contract for the American Dream. The 10-point agenda includes the following planks: create 21st-century energy jobs, invest in America's infrastructure and public education, offer Medicare for all, make work pay, secure Social Security, return to fairer tax rates, end U.S. wars abroad, tax Wall Street speculation, and strengthen democracy. Rebuild the Dream activists will gather for their first national get-together at the Take Back the American Dream Summit meeting October 3rd through 5th in Washington. Your reporter spoke with Natalie Foster, CEO of Rebuild the Dream, who discusses how the campaign plans to challenge corporate-driven politics in Washington and the difficulties in organizing a unified and effective progressive alliance.
You know, the last couple of years, the economic crisis has gotten really bad in this country. And in fact, the American dream is, you know, under attack. Veterans come home from the wars they're fighting to fewer jobs and, you know, a little on the home front. Young people are graduating into what is the worst job market in decades. The big banks that, you know, we, the American taxpayers, bailed out won't cut homeowners a break in their underwater mortgages. And, you know, nurses and firefighters and cops and teachers, sort of our everyday heroes, are, you know, in many cases thrown out in the street due to really severe cuts. So all of those examples are the American dream under attack. And people within each of those groups are starting to fight back. You know, you see all kinds of exciting movement where people are saying, no, this is the country I want, like we saw in Wisconsin several months ago, where tens of thousands of people, you know, showed up to support everyday heroes in Wisconsin. And so we started looking around and said, will these people fight back together or will they fight back alone? We believe that what we're seeing right now is the emergence of the American Dream movement. It's a movement that wants to support and build and restore the middle class. And so that's what Rebuild the Dream is all about. It's a hub for the American Dream movement that is a coalition, but bigger than a coalition. It's a number of groups are participating in it, but so are a whole lot of individuals around the country.
How much is this project a reaction to the success of the Tea Party in really driving the agenda in Washington, D.C., although it seems quite divorced from the reality in the rest of the country? They have certainly been successful in driving media coverage of the political debate and hence having a lot of influence on Republicans and certainly many Democrats, including President Obama.
I think in 2009, the Tea Party really changed politics. And the American Dream Movement, I believe, is a voice for the silent majority of Americans who believe that, you know, if you work hard in this country and, you know, play by the rules, that you should be able to have a good life and take care of your children. We're, I believe, quite different from the Tea Party, but there are a couple of interesting design features, if you will, that the Tea Party had. One is, you know, it's the Tea Party brand is actually a whole number of things underneath it. A whole bunch of conservative fights around the country can be the sort of local taxpayer group, but also be part of the Tea Party. And there was some power in that that we saw in 2009. And two is that they're a leaderless organization. They sort of operate like a swarm, if you will. There's, you know, nobody calling the shots, and that's something quite powerful that you're able to do in modern times with technology. And so I think those design features and a number of other things are part of the American Dream movement as well, that, you know, there are lots of different groups from Planned Parenthood to Sierra Club participating and are creating the American Dream movement, and it truly is a leaderless effort.
Natalie, I wanted to ask you about the difficulties in organizing a strong national progressive alliance to effectively push hard on a broad agenda, which is what you're trying to do, unifying groups with different issue agendas that don't often work together. And we've seen efforts like this over the years with progressive groups, and some people might say it's as difficult as herding cats, as the saying goes. But I'm wondering if you think there's something different here where we're going to see a really strong and effective progressive coalition emerge where people are really coming together for everybody acting on each other's important issues as opposed to, you know, staying very singular in their issue outlook.
Well, I think that's a very good question. And I think it's actually the central question that we're trying to answer. Will progressives continue to fight alone in their different silos, or will we fight together under one big banner? You know, it, really what we're fighting for, with if you're many of these groups, is the American Dream. There's just different pieces of it that we're sort of organized around, but there's got to be sort of the big picture, and that's what I think you see emerging, and that's what I think is really exciting. We're at a real turning point, I think, for the future of the country, certainly for future generations. And I think you're seeing some exciting organizing because of that.
That was Natalie Foster, CEO of the Rebuild the American Dream campaign. Find more information about the campaign by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.